Thank you, Igor. Let me also thank all the organizers for the invitation. It's great to be back at Perimeter in person for a conference. It's been a long time since I've spoken in person. It's a great experience. So I'll be talking about some pretty recent work in which we kind of explore the use of this unusual diagnostic called measurement-induced entanglement to detect sign structure of wave functions. And this is work done with two postdocs, Jacob and Yijun, and also two grad students, Weicheng and Shengji. I'll be a little bit constrained on time and won't have the chance to go into full detail, but if you're curious, they can all be found in this recent preprint here. Okay, so the motivation for this talk is basically the elephant in this room, sign problem, sign structure. So as you all know, this is a major headache for many of you. But is the sign problem and sign structure just a problem of computational complexity? Or are there more physical aspects of sign structure? And if sign structure is actually, you know, something physically meaningful, how do we detect it? What are the observable manifestations of sign structure? Right? Or in other words, given a system that's sign-free versus one that has sign structure, how can I distinguish the two apart from investigating exponentially many amplitudes? Right? Is there something more physically meaningful that distinguishes the two? So let me say a tiny bit about sign structure. This is mostly preaching to the choir here. So as y'all know, standard path integral Monte Carlo simulations require some local basis in which the Hamiltonian off-diagonal matrix elements are real and non-positive. This allows one to map to a classical partition function that can be sampled with Monte Carlo methods. And here, there's already this question of, does there exist a local basis in which these constraints exist, right? And this question of, does there exist a local basis already suggests a connection to quantum phases of matter, which are defined as equivalence classes up to local basis changes or local unitary operations, right? And so this begs the question, are there quantum phases of matter with an intrinsic sign problem? Namely, a sign problem in which there's no choice of local basis in which this is possible. Okay. So in 2015, Matt Hastings showed that actually every commuting projector Hamiltonian with a certain type of topological order called double Semian order has such a sign problem. Yeah, so such an intrinsic sign problem is really a characteristic of an entire phase of matter. And this was shortly after extended to many different topological orders by Zohar Ringel and collaborators. So this gives you a taste of how, you know, sign structure is already deeply connected to different quantum phases of matter. And indeed, the sign structure at the level of wave functions, in particular ground state wave functions, is also important, right? So just like for the sign structure of a Hamiltonian, I can also ask for a ground state wave function, is there a choice of local basis in which all the amplitudes of that wave function can be chosen to be real and non-negative? That would be a sign-free wave function, right? And if that's not possible, then that wave function would have an intrinsic sign problem. And so such a sign problem or sign structure at the level of a ground state wave function implies a sign problem for any parent Hamiltonian for that wave function. And that's because if you could find a parent Hamiltonian that's sign-free, then you could just evolve in imaginary time for infinite time and get the ground state written in that basis with real non-negative weights. Okay. So the takeaway of this slide is just that sign structure is pretty physical, and now there's this question: how do we detect it? Right.
I have a question.
Yes.
If you dig in
I think the most important aspect is it has to be robust to local basis changes, right? Because if you allow for arbitrary basis change, then everything is trivial. Everything is connected to each other by a global unitary, right? But if you restrict yourself to, you know, defining your equivalence class up to local unitary or local basis change, then you can have non-trivial classes that are distinct from each other.
And by local, you mean local is a
local in Yes. So some tensor product structure and locality in that structure, right? Yeah, thank you. Okay, so this begs the question, how do you detect sine structure in either a wave function or a Hamiltonian? Yes, Liu?
Can you go back one step?
Sure. Yeah.
I think the other statement is really saying the sine problem of the wave function either requires the sine problem of the parent Hamiltonian, or we can have a sine problem free Hamiltonian that has degeneracy other than those ground states. Can I say that?
So you're worried that the sine free Hamiltonian, when you evolve, might not give you that precise ground state.
Yeah, maybe there's
There could be some degeneracy, but I think there's probably a choice of basis for that degeneracy in which each element is sine free. I think there is a statement along that line, but it might require some more care. Yeah.
Thanks.
Yeah. Yes.
One more question. When you formulate the sine structure in this particular way, do fermions also fall in this class? Because there's a whole bunch of fermion quantum field theories which are free of sine problems, but I would have thought that by definition, if there are lots of fermions, there's nothing local about them to solve a sine problem. So typically you have determinants and things like that.
That's a good question. So I haven't, to be honest, I haven't thought that much about the fermionic systems. Most of this talk will be focused on bosonic, but yeah, it's Right. So I'm not sure how to think about fermions yet. Yeah, but it's a good question. Yeah, thanks. Right. Well, no. I mean, we're defining a local basis for the system, not asking whether the state itself is local or non-local, right? So, I would say you define some single particle orbitals, maybe like a Vanier basis, right? And you consider like that basis as a local basis, right? I have to think more about the fermionic version of all this. Thanks. Yeah.
Okay, so I have a similar question about fermions before you move away from there. I mean, when you use the word problem, so I just want to understand, is it something you are trying to get rid of, or is it intrinsic because of some deeper, you say, Pauli exclusion or exchange statistics? How are you using the word?
Right, so that's a very good point that In the cases I mentioned, like double semion and these other topological orders, that intrinsic sine problem is closely connected to the statistics of the anions in that theory, right? So indeed, that's an important aspect. And so that's why you end up with these both being connected universally, right? You have this phase of sine structure that's related to the phase of the anion statistics, and they're all related to each other.
Okay, so in that case, you're not trying to get rid of it, because that is what defines the quantum
yeah,
state.
Yeah. The statement here is that you cannot get rid of it.
Yes, right?
Which is unfortunate for maybe Monte Carlo simulations, but here we like to view it as like a feature, like a physical property to be explored.
Okay.
Because, you know, these actually exist in materials, maybe, and we'd like to see what are the consequences of the sign problem there.
Thank you.
Yeah, thanks for all the questions. Indeed, the question is, how do we detect sign structure of a wave function? And so very nice progress is made by again, Matt Hastings in this same paper. So what he found is that if you have a one-dimensional sign-free state with zero correlation length, then what he did was consider a diagnostic where you measure the bulk of the system in the basis in which the state is sign-free, so say the computational basis, and you ask how much entanglement does there exist in the remaining pieces after these measurements were made. Okay. And what he found is that due to the sign-freeness of the state, the entanglement you can induce after measurement in such a way is very small. In fact, it decays super polynomially with the distance between these two pieces. And one rough picture for this claim is the following. So such a state can be approximated by what's called a coherent Gibbs state. This is basically a wave function where all the amplitudes are given by Boltzmann weights of some local classical Hamiltonian. Okay. And here, the locality follows from the zero correlation length assumption, and the classicality follows from the sign-free assumption. Okay. And this coherent Gibbs state form allows one to better understand this limited measurement-induced entanglement. And that's because when you make the measurement in this bulk, you're basically fixing some classical configuration, right? And after you fix that classical configuration, the remaining state on the left and right pieces are just given by the local Boltzmann weights for the left and the right. And so that remaining state is approximately separable and has very little entanglement. Okay. So that's a rough picture for this nice claim. So I'll refer to this diagnostic as measurement-induced entanglement, or MIE. And in fact, a very similar concept was considered in this even older paper by Vrstrada, Pop, and Sirach, which they consider something called localizable entanglement. Okay, so this is a great step forward in seeing what are the consequences of sign freeness. Here, Hastings suggested that it limits this measurement-induced entanglement. However, there is this very strong assumption of zero correlation length. And this is something that we'd like to relax. So this work is basically about how to detect sign structure more generally, basically in states where the correlation length is effectively infinite. And the central proposal we'd like to make is that for a sign-free state, the entanglement induced by measuring in the sign-free basis must decay at least as fast as existing correlations in the state before measurement. So in other words, the sign freeness of a state makes it so that measurements cannot generate any more correlations than those that already existed. Okay, that's the central proposal. And the flip side is that violations of this restricted measurement-induced entanglement serve as a direct fingerprint of sign structure. There are things that sign-full states can do that sign-free states cannot. And we'll be focusing on quantum critical states. I guess that was post-selected by this conference. And I'll show you cases where we can actually show that sign structure can constrain the critical data of the theory. So, okay, full disclosure, we cannot show this in full generality. However, we can make sharp statements in several contexts. So the first context I'll talk about is what's called stabilizer states. I'll remind you what that is. And for sign-free stabilizer states, we can prove this bound that the measurement-induced entanglement between A and B is upper bounded by the mutual information between A and B. And I'll show you that this provides constraints on some interesting quantum criticality emerging from quantum dynamics. That's been a topic of recent interest. And I'll also show that for a qubit wave function, The measurement induced entanglement between two qubits A and B is upper bounded by the simple correlation function. And I'll illustrate this in our favorite spin chain models. Okay, that's a rough outline. So now let me just dive into the details. First, let me define more carefully what measurement induced entanglement is. So let's divide our full system into three parts, A, B, and C. And the measurement induced entanglement is defined as follows. So we measure C in some given basis, let's say computational basis, and then we get some outcome, little c, with a probability PC. And after we obtain that particular outcome, little c, we get a residual state on A and B that I'll call psi AB, comma C. Okay. And SA is just the entanglement between A and B for that residual state, psi AB. So the MIE is nothing but the weighted average of the entanglement between A and B over all possible outcomes you get after measuring C. Okay. And throughout this talk, we'll want to compare this quantity MIE to more standard measures, like correlation functions between A and B, or the mutual information between A and B, which is actually an upper bound for the square of connected correlators between A and B. Okay. So now we want to explore what are the consequences of sign freeness or sign structure for this class of stabilizer states. So just to remind you, Pauli strings are simply tensor products of Pauli operators, and stabilizer states are eigenstates of commuting Pauli strings. Okay, so most of you probably know the Torah code ground states. These are stabilizer states in which the stabilizers or Pauli strings are just the star and Plaquette operators. Okay, so now we'll derive some constraints due to the sign freeness for stabilizer states. So the first thing we can show is that for a sign-free stabilizer state, we can choose all the stabilizers to consist of only X-type operators or only Z-type operators. And in the quantum information community, this is known as a CSS code. But again, the Torah code is another great example of such a state. The star and Plaquette operators are either all X or all Z-type, right? And the more important property that we can show is that for such a sign-free stabilizer state, after measuring C in the sign-free basis, in this case, either the Z or the X basis, the entanglement induced between A and B is upper bounded by the mutual information between A and B. So let me illustrate this in some very simple toy examples first. So let's consider just three qubits and a simple state in which A and B are in an EPR pair and C is decoupled. Okay. So here the mutual information between A and B is 2, and it's clear that measuring C, which is decoupled from the system, that doesn't do anything. It cannot generate anything extra. So the measurement induced entanglement between A and B is precisely what was there before, just a single bit of entanglement. And so this clearly satisfies the bound. A more non-trivial example is a GHZ, or cat state, all up plus all down. So this is another sign-free stabilizer state, stabilized by ZZs, or the product of all Xs. And here the mutual information between A and B is 1. There's classical correlation. And however, if you measure C in the X basis, then one can check that after measurement, you get a Bell pair on A and B stabilized by ZZ and XX. Okay, so after the X measurement was done, you have 1 bit of entanglement between A and B. But again, this bound is satisfied, okay, saturated. And of course, if you measure the cat state in the Z basis, then you just collapse the cat to a product state, and you have no entanglement in that case. Okay, so in all cases, for this simple toy states, this bound is satisfied. Okay, and it turns out that this analysis is pretty much all we need to prove this claim in full generality for sign-free stabilizers. And that's because there's this very nice structure theorem for stabilizers proved by these people. And the theorem says that if you have a stabilizer state on A, B, and C, then there exists some local unitaries supported on A, B, and C, which transform the stabilizer into just a direct product of either GHZ states on three parties, EPR pairs on two parties, or product states. So there's a simple local unitaries on A, B, and C that decouple the state into one of these three states, or just a direct product of these three states. Okay. So we will need a finer structure theorem, specialized to sign-free stabilizers. And what we're able to show is that for a sign-free stabilizer, these local unitaries, UA, UB, UC, can be chosen to be sign-free preserving. That is, they map Z-type to Z-type and X-type to X-type stabilizers. And this is important because this means that they'll commute with the projective measurements we're making on the C system. And this means that to evaluate MIE and MI on the left-hand side, we can just evaluate all of those for the right-hand side, which is much easier. Those are the simple toy states we considered on the previous slide. And so in there, we proved this bound. So that means that the bound applies to an arbitrary sign-free stabilizer state. Okay, so now we want to see what are the consequences of this bound for some interesting quantum critical points. Yes?
Can I ask a question to the previous one?
Yeah, sure.
So it doesn't sound very surprising to me to, if you look at the next example, that if you have already a maximally entangled state between A and B,
yeah,
that then the inequality is satisfied.
Yeah. That's a good point. It works there as well because when you measure C, then C becomes decoupled, but then B also becomes decoupled, right? So again, you cannot generate new correlation by doing measurement, right? Yeah. Yeah. Well, it turns out one. You mean if it's still within the sign-free class, or yeah. So this is still an open question for us. Like, this may be true more generally, but we don't know how to show it in full generality. But we are able to say some other things that I'll show later. Yeah. Okay. Thanks. Right, so we proved this inequality due to the sign-freeness of stabilizers, and now we want to see what are the consequences are for some interesting quantum critical points. So the first class of quantum criticality I'll talk about may not be so familiar to this audience. Let me try to explain that here. So recently people have been considering quantum dynamics involving both random unitary time evolution interspersed with projective measurements, which are performed with some probability p. And people have been interested in basically the ensemble of steady states produced by this long time dynamics, and in particular the entanglement structure of these steady states. So the measurements here want to disentangle the system into product states or area loss states. Whereas the random unitaries want to entangle everything into volume law or highly entangled states, right? So those are the two phases in this case, the two phases of these steady states. You have volume law steady states and area law steady states. And at a critical probability of measurement rate, there's this fascinating critical point in which the entanglement structure itself transitions from volume to area law. And so it's this type of criticality that we'll be interested in. However, it turns out that one doesn't even need unitary evolution to have interesting critical points in this setup. Even with measurements only, one can drive interesting critical points. So here's one, probably one of the simplest examples of this. So say you have a 1D chain of qubits, and you measure, and you have two types of operations. you either measure nearest neighbor qubits with ZZ measurement, or you perform single site X measurement. Okay, those are your two operations, and you perform each with some probability. So the ZZ measurements want to basically fuse all the qubits into a big GHZ or cat state, whereas the X measurements want to disentangle and basically poke holes into these big GHZ states. And so these ZZX measurements are competing. And it turns out that when they occur with equal probability, then one ends up with a critical ensemble of steady states in which the steady states are basically a direct product of GHZ states whose size are given by some power law distribution. Okay, so when they occur with equal probability, one has this critical point in the dynamical steady states of these circuits. Okay, and much more can be said about this simple toy model. It maps the 2D percolation, et cetera. But for our purposes, all we need are, one, this dynamics is sign-free preserving, and two, at all times, the state of the circuit is just some direct product of GHZ states. Okay. And so since the state is so simple, it's a direct product of GHZ states, we can just apply computations of the type we did before and analyze mutual information, measurement induced entanglement for such GHZ states. So it's simple to just check that the mutual information between A and B is non-zero if A and B are linked by some GHZ cluster. And this is also the same condition for the measurement induced entanglement when you measure in the X basis to be non-zero. They both already require A and B to be already in the same GHZ cluster. So this is just to give you hopefully some intuition why the measurement induced entanglement in the X basis should closely track the mutual information for this class of steady states. So it turns out that this critical point has conformal symmetry, and as you probably know, for such states, it's convenient to plot everything in terms of the cross ratio, which is defined as this ratio of chordal distances. And as usual, we'll be interested in the limit of A and B being small intervals that are very far apart, or the limit of small cross ratio. So we can look at this dynamical critical steady state and plot both mutual information and measurement-induced entanglement in the X and the Z basis versus this cross ratio on a log-log plot. And as expected, everything decays with the power law with cross ratio. And as I argued for in the previous slide, the mutual information closely tracks the measurement-induced entanglement in the X basis. They have the same power 1/3, which can be understood analytically. And so this is all just to illustrate that the results of this model are consistent with this bound on sign-free stabilizer states I showed before. The MIE cannot decay any slower than the MI.
Sorry, can I ask you a question on that?
Yeah, sure.
I didn't really understand the plot. So I assume eta is something you measure. You're tuning something, right?
Right. So eta here is a property of the geometry here.
Right. So, but what are you changing about your circuit?
I wasn't very clear. So we're basically changing, in this case, the sizes of A and B and their relative distance.
Okay. So you have the circuit that you showed in the previous.
Yeah. We're running that many times, generating an ensemble of steady states, and then looking at this such quantities averaged over all those steady states.
Okay, yeah. Thanks.
Thank you. Okay, so this can be made slightly more formal, in fact. So what these authors showed was that these power laws I showed, these power laws for measurement-induced entanglement and mutual information are all actually dictated by these quantities here, which are the lowest scaling dimensions of certain boundary condition changing operators of the corresponding CFTs. So phrased in this language, this bound we have for sign-free stabilizers actually implies this bound on scaling dimensions for sign-free stabilizer critical points. So we found it quite interesting that the sign structure is a pretty, at least naively, a UV aspect of the wave function, but somehow it's dictating some constraints on the IR physics, in this setting at least. Yeah. Which thing in particular?
MIE.
Yeah, so here MIE is measured in the sign-free basis, either X or Z. Yeah.
Would you say MIE called
an MIE? Right. Okay. So here they were looking at the full hybrid circuit, which I'll show in the next slide, in which the measurement basis is pretty much irrelevant. It doesn't matter. But for our purposes, we would need to add a further detail to this HFF quantity and demand that it's measured in the X basis. That would be a particular boundary condition specific to that basis. This will be irrelevant for the next thing I'll present. Thanks for pointing that out. Okay, so that's sign-free stabilizer dynamics and the restrictions on that. So how do we get dynamics in this class with sign structure? And how do we see violation of that bound? So for that, we don't have to look very hard. Just the original dynamics involving both random unitary and measurement will give you plenty of signs in the state. The random unitaries are adding signs all over the place, right? So now we'll be focusing on the original critical point that was investigated, the entanglement transition between volume law and area law for these Clifford circuits. So again, we can compute this measurement-induced entanglement, mutual information, for this ensemble of steady states at the critical point and plot it against the cross ratio, right? And here we find something very different from before. Right. So here, the mutual information decays with some power 2, whereas the measurement-induced entanglement decays with a much smaller power, 0.43. So here, this bound that I claimed is severely violated, and this is a direct consequence of the sign structure of this hybrid circuit transition. Okay, and let me ignore that side comment for now. Okay, so that's a. I hope I at least gave you a taste of some. Yeah, five. Okay.
Can I ask a quick question?
Right.
So you started out by saying sign structure of the wave function.
Yes.
And typically, my picture is you start out in this path integral with some state and you evolve it for a long time with mm-hmm. no measurements.
Right.
And that's how you would then get your wave function.
Yeah.
But here, because you're measuring, it's not a wave function anymore.
Yeah. So indeed, the class of criticality is slightly different in this case. We're not dealing with criticality of a single wave function. We're considering an ensemble of steady states and looking at the average behavior of that. And it still exhibits criticality that, in this case, actually is described by a conformal field theory, et cetera. But indeed, it's different.
Okay.
So here, in the little remaining time I have, I'll focus on the class that you described that indeed may be more interesting to this audience. Right? So here we'll be going back to our bread and butter spin chains and their ground states and looking at the consequences of sign structure there. In retrospect, I probably should have started with this. So another thing that we can show is that for qubit wave functions, if A and B are restricted to be single qubits, then for a sign-free wave function, the measurement-induced entanglement is upper bounded by just a simple XX correlation function on those two qubits. Okay, and
how do you choose the X operator? So this will depend on which operator you choose, right?
Yeah, indeed. So again, the sign-free assumption itself assumes it's sign-free in a particular basis, right? So We're assuming, we're assuming psi is sine free in, say, the computational or z basis. That fixes the z basis. Now the x basis is well defined. Yeah, thanks.
So what about, I mean, then suppose I consider SU2 invariant spin system. So I don't know what z basis is.
I think one can still define the x operator, right?
Oh, okay, fine. Yeah. Okay, you can still define the SD. Okay.
Yeah. Right. Okay. So in consideration of time, I won't show you the proof. But the result here is just that MIE is upper bounded by just a simple XX correlation function. Right, and so let's see what the consequences of this are for our favorite spin chain models. So one should always start with a transistorializing model. Just as a reminder, this is 1D transistorializing, and so we can plot all these quantities of interest with respect to the separation between A and B for this critical ground state. Right, so here the black series is just the XX correlation function decays with some power, and MIE and MI decay with all these powers here. And so we find that the measurement-induced entanglement in the Z basis decays with pretty much the same power as the XX correlation function. Okay, so the MIE decays with the same power as the slowest correlator, the XX correlator here. And again, this is consistent with that bound I showed. The MIE is upper bounded by the XX correlator. Here, the bound is pretty much saturated. And so this plot was for A and B being single qubits, but we can actually vary the sizes of A and B and consider similar plots as before, where we plot against the cross ratio of the geometry now. And again, we find similar things. But the interesting point here is that this measurement-induced entanglement seems to be a function only of the cross ratio, and thus seems to correspond to some object in the conformal field theory, but this is actually not quite understood yet. We don't know which conformal boundary condition is relevant for this MIE computation. Okay, and so now we like to consider a critical ground state with sine structure in which these bounds can be violated, right? Just like for the stabilizer case, we found that the hybrid circuit has plenty of sine structure and violates that bound. So for this example, we turn to what's called gapless SPT states. We consider a critical point between the cluster state SPT, which is protected by a Z2 cross Z2 symmetry, and a ferromagnet. So this is tuned to a critical point between these two phases. I don't have time to go into detail, but again, for our purposes, all we need is the fact that this critical ground state is not sine-free in either the X or the Z basis. Okay. And so we expect to see sharp violation of that bound I just showed you before, and indeed, this is what happens. So here we again plot all these MIE, MI correlation functions versus the distance between A and B. And here the MIE is actually constant. It doesn't decay at all. And that's basically because of a string order parameter in this model that derives from the neighboring cluster state SPT. Okay, so this MIE state is infinitely long-ranged, whereas all the existing correlation functions decay with some power law, like the mutual information decays with the power law. So here the MIE does not decay faster than the slowest correlation function. This is a direct fingerprint of the non-trivial sine structure. Okay. Okay, yeah, I'd just like to wrap up. I'm sorry I had to rush to the end, but happy to address any questions. So I think there are still many open questions for this work. First, we'd like to find an example of a 1D critical ground state with an intrinsic sine problem, a sine problem where no local basis change can remove the signs. The gapless SPT example I showed you comes close. It's most likely a symmetry-protected sine problem there, but there exists a local basis in which there are no signs there, too. And I think the most important question is to understand how all these things, how MIE, how its sign structure are encoded in the IR or the CFD data. What are the proper conformal boundary conditions to consider in computing MIE in the field theory, let's say? So I'm most interested in this question at this point. And here's just the overview of the results. And again, apologies for the time crunch.
There were lots of questions already, so of course you're right on time. So further questions? Maybe you should use the microphone so that people online can also hear it.
So Tim, this cluster state to feral transition.
Yeah.
In terms of universality class, that's just icing, right? So presumably the MIE you got should also correspond to something in the conventional icing transverse chain.
Yeah. So it can be mapped to some quantity in the Ising CFT, but that's like a non-local transformation,
okay.
Right? Yeah, so we described that in the paper, the okay. Precise mapping in the appendix.
Okay,
yeah.
All right, thanks.
Other questions?
So for the previous example with the easing,
yes.
Standard easing,
yeah.
I didn't really get the point. So do I have to compare the exponents or do I have to compare the quantities themselves?
Yeah, thank you. So the bound I showed is just for the quantities themselves when A and B are two qubits, right? But that implies a bound on the power law decay.
But right? If I extend this to the very left, wouldn't that mean that the red curve somewhere crosses one of the other curves? I mean, if these are different exponents and these are really linear curves, shouldn't that, in this log-log plot, shouldn't these curves then cross somewhere?
No, so the bound is that the MIE is upper bounded by the XX correlation function.
I see. Right?
So yeah, it's always above the green and the red here.
Ah.
Right.
Okay.
Yeah, the bound is for the MIE for the Z basis measurement. So the bound is between the black and the green curves.
Ah, okay.
Yeah.
Okay. Okay.
Other questions? No questions online either. Well, there are lots of questions during the talk, so unless we have any other questions, I think we should maybe finish the morning session. Okay. Thank you very much.